the different mental factors, the different aspects of our mind that relate to objects in various ways. So we've been talking, just finished talking about the five omnipresent mental factors and the five object ascertaining mental factors, and we're now on the 11 virtuous mental factors. So this is all the good stuff. Okay. So we've already talked about faith or confidence, and about a sense of personal integrity and consideration for others. And we actually made it through non-attachment, and none of you freaked out too badly. You're still alive, even though we talked about non-attachment. And now we've come to non-hatred. Okay. So, non-hatred is a distinct mental factor, and that when referring to one of three objects, that is, someone who harms us, the harm itself, or the cause of the harm, bears the characteristics of love, which directly overcomes anger and hatred. It is the basis for the prevention of anger and the increase of love and patience. Okay, so it talks about three different objects here, that are anger or hatement or resentment or belligerence or irritation or annoyance, all these little joys. Those attitudes get generated towards. So one is the person who harms us, okay? So the guy who smashes our car, the guy who tells us off, the one who ruins our reputation, talks behind our back, you know, these people, okay? So the person who harms us. Then the second object that our anger can get aroused towards is the harm itself. In other words, the unpleasant sensation, the harm itself. So, for example, when we get sick, we often get angry. And we get angry at being sick, don't we? You know, I'm angry because I have the flu. I'm angry because I have a headache. I'm angry because I have a cold. So we're angry at the harm itself. Kind of interesting, isn't it? You know, as if the disease had a personality and an intention to cause us harm. Okay? Anyway, you know, whether it does or not, we get angry at it. And then the third object is the instrument of the harm, okay? Or the cause of the harm. So this could refer to the tape recorder, for example. Okay? The thing that you're counting on to work and it doesn't work. Yeah. So, there's lots of things like this in our life where, you know, we go out to start our car and the battery's dead. And I think you've all heard me tell the story of when I worked doing research at this machine that didn't work and I had to kick it and it got worked. So, you know, we can get angry at also, non-living beings. We get angry at the weather, don't we? It's August, and it looks like November. Okay, so we're angry at the temperature. So any of these three kinds of things, the person, the harm itself, or the instrument, the cause of the harm. Okay, and so we get angry at those things, and so patience is an attitude that is able to go through whatever difficulties we encounter with those three objects. So instead of freaking out and wanting to flee or attack, patience, you know, has the ability just to accept the situation and deal with it as it is. Okay? So patience or non-hatred or love, these are things that are cultivated. It's not like we're born with a patient mentality or patient character, you know. It's something that we cultivate. In a similar way, you know, with anger, we have a certain amount of anger, like we have a certain amount of patience, but we can cultivate our anger or we can cultivate our patience. So it's our choice, it's our decision. And this is basically what spiritual practice is about, is deciding what things we want to cultivate and what things we want to abandon. Okay, so So the non-hatred is, it's not referring to the behavior, it's referring to our attitude. Okay, so there's a big difference. Yeah? But this attitude is one that's able to be clear. So when we lack non-hatred, when we lack patience, then instead of clarity, our mind gets really riled up, it gets very confused, very agitated. We stop thinking clearly when we're under the influence of anger and bitterness and grudges. And because of this unclarity of mind, then all the external methods we generally take to remedy the situation, so many of them backfire because we're not thinking clearly. So with patience, we're able to think a little bit clearly and communicate better. And I notice this often when there's that conflict with somebody that we really care about. I saw it very clearly one time when a very good friend of mine, we were supposed to meet, and he was really late. And, you know, and I was very worried. And when he finally showed up and he told me that the lid of his car flew up on the freeway, you know, the hood flew up, so he was driving the freeway. You know, I mean, I got really mad at him because, you know, he should have fixed the hood before and it was so dangerous and why did he do that? And if that happened, why didn't he call me and tell me he was going to be late? And da-da-da-da-da, you know. I'm sure you could write the script. And, you know, I mean, that kind of harsh speech came out because of the anger and the upset inside. But it was very interesting because after I calmed down, what I realized I really wanted to convey was that I cared about this person and I was worried. But I didn't say that. And I didn't express the care. All I expressed was anger. You know, so I think very often situations like this happen where we actually care a great deal about somebody, but we don't express the care, we express the anger because of something that happened. So that happens, you know, that miscommunication or the way we express ourselves, we don't express ourselves properly, comes because the mind lacks clarity due to the anger. Whereas when we have this mental factor of non-hatred, of patience, then the mind has clarity. We can actually express what we mean to express instead of expressing the opposite. Because so often when we express the opposite, then the other person builds on top of that, don't they? And pretty soon we have a knockdown drag-out going. Okay, so this mental factor is not simply an absence of the intent to harm, but it's a wish not to harm. It's not just, you know, I'm sleeping so I'm not getting angry, that kind of absence of anger. But it's the absence, it's the actual antidote to the anger. So it's the thing that blocks the anger. Okay? So again, it's not a suppression of the anger or a repression of the anger. Patience doesn't mean stuffing it in and putting on a big smile when we're boiling inside. No, the patience actually means transforming our own mind. And this is real important because what I find we often make the mistake of doing in our lives is when we have a problem, instead of looking at our mind and trying to work out the feelings, we usually look at the situation and think, what should I do to remedy the situation? Yeah. Yeah, that usually when there's a conflict, we don't so much look at it in our own minds and try and remedy the agitation and anger in our own minds, but we don't approach the problem that way, but we look at the external problem and think, what should I say, what should I do, how can I make the external problem different? Okay, so that kind of lack of tuning into where we're at and making some changes in where we're at often makes it very difficult when we come to resolve the conflict because we're not thinking clearly, so we don't choose appropriate means. Okay? And so we often misunderstand and we think patience means, you know, dealing with the external situation, finding a way to avoid the conflict. I mean, for a long time I thought patience just meant avoid conflict. Yeah? Patience doesn't mean avoid conflict. because we can do lots of stuff to avoid overt conflict, but inside we're raging. Okay? So patience is not talking about our external behavior. It's talking about our internal attitude. And it really pays off when we're agitated to, instead of, you know, just put on hold this whole mind that wants to figure out what to say and do, and just sit and kind of look at our own mind and, you know, why am I angry and what are my buttons that are getting pushed and what's going on here? And then do some of the meditations on patience to suit, you know, to calm the mind down. So we can reflect that, you know, the event that we're experiencing is a result of our own negative karma. Yeah, it's coming about because of the harm we've given to others in the past, which was caused by our own self-cherishing. So it's kind of no wonder, no mystery that we're getting some flack now. Or we can look at it and see what our buttons are that are getting pushed in this situation. So all these different kinds of ways of meditation to look at the situation in order to deal with our own mind. When our own mind is calmer, then it's easier to go talk to the other person. Okay. Now, on the other hand, there's another extreme we can go to. And considering we're not bodhisattvas, yet, although some of you may be, I'm not. There is another extreme of thinking, well, if I only sit on my cushion long enough, I should be able to solve the problem. And so we don't talk to the other person, we don't check out the information we have, we just think, well, I've got to sit on my cushion till the anger goes away. And I tried that for a long time, and then I realized that, well, no, sometimes what we really need is a combined effort of sitting on the cushion dealing with my anger and actually talking to the other person too. And it was quite amusing during the retreat. Something happened that had to do with a person that was not in Seattle, and, you know, something was going on and da-da-da-da-da, and I got a phone message, or, you know, I saw a phone message written down that said da-da-da-da-da, and I was getting really angry because this person was supposed to do something else and the phone message was this, you know. And so kind of several days went by in the retreat, and I'm saying, okay, be patient, and this person means well, and they don't really mean harm. Oh, and it's okay, and it'll all work out in the end. So kind of, you know, going through this. Yeah. And then after about, you know, 5 or 6 days, I tell somebody else who's involved in this situation and say, did you know this? And they said, well, you know, I got a completely different message. And they called the person, and sure enough, the message they got was right, and the one I read had been written down incorrectly. So I was getting angry because of stuff that was written down incorrectly. You know? And if I had taken the time to check the information I got at the beginning, I would have saved myself 5 or 6 days of being upset over nothing. You know? It was very, very interesting. Yeah, it is. Because so often, and even to check if we heard something correctly, you know, and if we and even if we heard it correctly, to really ask the other person if our ideas of why they said or did this is really their ideas of why they said or did it. Because often it's very, very different. But we just assume all of this, and then we get angry when actually there's no basis for the anger. You know? So this involves a lot of listening skills, which is, you know, why I think it fits in very well with Buddhist practice to learn communication skills and conflict resolution and mediation, because all of this has to do with how we enact our patient attitude. And how sometimes, you know, just this idea of checking out information before we get angry can save us a lot of anger. But it's funny because sometimes we're too proud to check out the information, or we're too sure of our own interpretation. But it's very helpful sometimes to just say to somebody, you know, this is what you did. I assumed it was because blah, 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 blah. Is that what was going on? And often they say no. We're like, but I thought. Yeah? So, it can be very helpful to do that. Okay, so, we should try and work, you know, on our own mind in conjunction with checking the information out and communicating with the other person. And sometimes we may not be able to completely solve our anger. I mean, in the scriptures they often talk about, you know, the great bodhisattva who's getting chopped in bits and beat up, who's completely patient, you know, and...
Smiling.
What?
Smiling.
Right, smiling, you know, making charity to the body. You know, and then we just get completely discouraged and think this is totally impossible. And, you know, what we have to realize is that we may not be the great bodhisattvas, but we can kind of start and try and do something. And when we get stuck, then go talk to somebody. Okay? So instead of going to the extreme of not looking inside and just blaming the other, or the extreme of just thinking I'll look in the cushion, but I won't talk to, look, I'll sit on the cushion and work it out and not talk to the other person. I think we often need a combined effort of doing both of those things. Yeah? And sometimes it's difficult to communicate when there's misunderstanding. Sometimes it's pretty scary. Yeah? But I always find it so interesting that for as difficult and scary as it is, if we don't do it, it usually comes out more painful. So if we remember that, then sometimes it gives us the courage to, you know, speak up and try and share with the other person. And together with sharing with them, it's really important that we listen. So again, you know, there's a whole field in communication studies that talks about listening skills, which is very important, because communicating with the other person doesn't just mean telling them what we think and what was going on with us. Okay? Communicating means, you know, figuring out how to say something so they'll understand, and then being really willing to listen. Because if we come to somebody and we want to talk about a problem, but we're not willing to listen, then there's not going to be a whole lot of communication. So it's very helpful sometimes when we're in the middle of this, and and kind of we want to say our own thing, and the other person has the floor, and they keep going on and on and on, and maybe they're even venting and dumping their stuff on us. It's very helpful just to remind ourselves, you know, I'll get a chance to talk. You know, my turn will come. I don't have to interrupt. I don't have to cut this person off. I don't have to blah, 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 you know. I can let them, if they need to say all this stuff, say it. You know, my turn will come, and so therefore I can listen to them. And then really try and listen. Instead of, you know, we hear a few words that set us off, and then, boy, you know, we shut down, we stop listening, don't we? Now we hear those few words, and then we're busy planning our whole response to them. So it's really important that we kind of take time and try and listen. Very, very important. And really be patient with that. And it's hard because it's oftentimes, you know, very tempting to cut in and interrupt the other person. Or it's very tempting to just split. Okay? We do both of those behaviors, don't we? You know? But in both of them, we're not listening. So somebody once pointed out that we have two ears and one mouth, and it's for a purpose. So really becoming a good listener, I think, is really important. And I'm talking a lot about communication skills because I sometimes think that, or I've sometimes have witnessed, that Buddhists think that all you need to do is meditate and you don't need to learn anything else. And, you know, I used to think this for a long time, too, so. But I don't think that's true. We need to learn different skills. We need to learn how to speak. We need to learn how to express ourselves. And we need to learn how to listen. And we need to learn how to use our body language to communicate. or to avoid miscommunication. No? And so if we really care about other sentient beings, and we care about resolving conflict, and about, you know, avoiding their getting angry at us unnecessarily, and us getting angry at them unnecessarily, then I think it's quite important that we take the time and learn these skills. Because they're like everything else. Well, we have to learn it. Just somebody might be a bodhisattva, but that doesn't mean that they know how to fly an airplane. So somebody might be a bodhisattva, but it doesn't mean that they necessarily have good speaking and listening skills. So, you know, hopefully they would, but not necessarily. So I think it's very complementary to our Dharma practice to learn these skills. You got a question? Exactly. Exactly. And in our life, theory and practical application are separate. Yeah? I mean, and Dharma simply describes our life. This is something to really think about. So we will try and have Bill Wilmot come again next year. Yeah? He was very good. Yeah? And it was really nice. He came to the first week of the retreat. Which was awesome. So he has quite a strong Dharma basis. So this mental factor of non-hatred, it includes patience, which is the attitude that's able to remain calm and peaceful in the face of harm or suffering. So that's quite a good attitude to be able to cultivate, because how are we ever going to go through our life without experiencing harm or suffering? You know, everybody gets harmed, everybody suffers, so, you know, this is the mental factor that's going to enable us to deal with those things without freaking out and being upset. And this mental factor also includes love, which is the wish for others to have happiness. So it enables us to, you know, really to wish others well, again, not depending on how they treat us. So the more we're able to generate that wish for others to be happy, the happier we're going to be. Whereas the more we remain really, really sensitive and easily offended, and really prickly, then the unhappier we're going to be. It's really true, isn't it? And you know, and when we're so sensitive to stuff, we never think that this is a condition that arises because of causes and effects, you know, and that our sensitivity or our being easily offended is something that is a changeable situation. We don't think of it like that. We think, this is the way I am, and this is the reality of the situation. You know, this person is being inconsiderate and rude and obnoxious and crazy and damaging and blah, blah, blah. We hardly ever think, you know, maybe I'm being too sensitive. Interesting, isn't it? And yet, you know, a lot of our sensitivity or our being easily offended is totally dependent on how we interpret and hear the, you know, what the interaction and what's going on. And that's why two different people can be present at the same thing, and one is offended and one isn't, because they interpret the incident in very, very different ways. So when we're all there, you know, kind of ready for people to offend us, ready for people to disrespect us, then of course we're going to get angry. And especially now, you know, in our society now, with, you know, being politically correct and, you know, and, you know, really remarking on every small thing everybody says, then often we create a lot more trouble and problem in our own mind. That doesn't mean necessarily just letting everything go, but there are some things where it's definitely better to let it go. And some things that maybe the other person didn't even mean harm, but we interpreted it that way. So that's why it's really helpful in our meditation to look and see if there's patterns of things that we get easily offended by. I remember one time, Tom, you and I had a really interesting conversation, and And we were talking about getting offended by things, and you were saying that for you, you get more offended when people who you don't know say something. And I was saying that I get more offended when people I do know, who I'm close to, say something. And that was, you know, it kind of flashed on me, because I couldn't believe that situations that would upset me, he just wouldn't get upset at, you know? I mean, he just wouldn't, because to me, if it's somebody I know and they say something mean, I mean, this is really serious. Whereas, you know, he was saying he just gives the person the benefit of the doubt and knows the relationship will patch itself up and they'll be able to talk it out. Whereas for me, I just go and go, ugh, you know? And yet on the other hand, you know, when people I don't know say something, because I get all sorts of stares and comments and stuff, you know, this doesn't bother me in the least. But he was saying for him, he's really sensitive about that. Yeah? So it was so interesting just to see how our own minds work and how our own minds create, you know, by the way we think, create the problem or don't create the problem. Yeah? Or solve the problem or don't solve the problem. Okay? But I think it's really interesting in that way to see if there's patterns. You know, are we a person, you know, a children type of person that gets real sensitive when you know somebody? Or a Tom type of person who gets sensitive when you don't know. Because it's real interesting. I mean, if we can get research and figure this out about ourselves, it gives us a tool to help us deal with situations. Because, you know, these things are definitely going to come up in life, aren't they? Nobody goes through life without getting criticized or, you know, dumped on or mistreated or whatever. I mean, it's a very common experience. So if we can develop some patience and some resilience and some love and forgiveness, then you know, it really makes us much happier. It was also very interesting during the retreat. We did one exercise when we were writing the thing. And I found it so interesting that sometimes it's really hard once we have a grudge towards somebody. You know, a grudge is anger or, you know, resentment that's lasted over a long period of time. So a lot of our unfinished business with people are simply grudges that we carry on for years and years and years. That when we have a grudge, we form such a rigid opinion of the other person that it becomes almost impossible for us to see anything good in them or to give them the benefit of the doubt. Or to think that they might have meant something else, or to consider that they may have been unhappy or suffering. You know, we trap ourselves so incredibly by our own rigid image of somebody. And that rigid image, which exists only in our mind, it does not exist in the other person, that rigid image really causes us pain year after year and sometimes even decade after decade. You know, when we carry around misgivings about things that happened 5, 10, 30, 50 years ago. Okay. So as much as we can develop this, you know, mental factor of non-hatred, it's really something that works for our own benefit. And I'm sure it would cause better physical health, too. So not only mental health, but physical health. Okay, any questions about this one before we go on to the next one? Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Okay, I have to repeat that into the tape recorder. Make sure it gets there. So the mantra of may I free others from the mental projections I put onto them. It's true, isn't it? Yeah. And, you know, I mean, that also helps the other person, too, because we know what it's like when we're the object of other people's mental projections and how uncomfortable it is. Somebody else? Yeah. You mean so how to actually understand that? Well, I don't know. I kind of feel that sometimes these things can't be forced. I think that we can't force, you know, kind of like, I'm blocked. What is it that happened that's blocking me? You know, because I think that we can drive ourselves crazy with that. But what I've noticed is sometimes just through the force of our meditation practice, as we meditate more and more, the dirt comes up. Yeah? So, it'll come up when it's ready to. I think the basic thing is just to practice. And as we practice, just to be aware. And sometimes it'll surface in our meditation, sometimes it surfaces in dreams. Yeah, well, deep psychology, it doesn't have the same idea of subconscious or unconscious. It's more, I think the Buddhist approach would be that there's a pattern of behavior going on. And look at the pattern rather than look at one specific event that illustrates that pattern. That's memory. It's memory and then dream, you know. And dream is just a dream. It's not real. I mean, I find sometimes in my dreams what I see is I'm just acting my usual habitual behavior, but suddenly in a dream I'm able to realize how obnoxious it is. You know? I don't know what it is, but it's every once in a while I wake up and it's like, well, yeah, I always do that. And it never works. It's completely stupid, you know. But it's like, I didn't realize how frequently I do it until I see it in the dream. So, I don't know. Did you hear something? There are three objects that we usually get angry at. Oh, no, no. Yeah. 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 We very much grab onto our patterns. This is me. And I'm not going to change, even if it hurts to be like me. I'm not going to change. So. Okay, should we go on to the next one? Now we have the third non. These are called the three nons. We had non-attachment, non-bewilderment, non-hatred, and now non-bewilderment. So, non-bewilderment, or sometimes it's also called non-closed-mindedness. Okay? I suppose I could think of something more complicated to call it if I tried. Yeah. So it's a distinct mental factor that arises from an inborn disposition or from hearing, from contemplation or meditation. And it acts as a remedy for bewilderment and accompanies the firm intelligence or wisdom that thoroughly analyzes the specific meanings of an object. It prevents bewilderment and increases the four types of intelligence and helps to actualize virtuous qualities. So again, a very important one. Now, you may remember, or you may not, when we talked in the five object ascertaining mental factors, that the last one there was intelligence, or sometimes called wisdom, Tibetan word sherab. And so this one is closely related to that, and there's a big debate about if they're the same thing or not the same thing. Okay, but it seems like they're not the same thing, but it's kind of a, they find a way to debate to make it not the same thing. At least the ones who believe that do. The ones who believe the other, okay, find a way to make it the same thing. But in any case, they are very closely related. Okay, so it has the aspect of really understanding. So it's a clarity and a sharpness of mind that's able to dispel the darkness of bewilderment. There's something clear and sharp about this one. Okay, it arises well, first of all, it's not talking about bewilderment like when you're lost and you don't know whether to turn right or left. Okay, and it's not talking about bewilderment when you sit down with a computer. It's talking about bewilderment or confusion that regards some things as such as the two truths, in other words, the understanding of the conventional and ultimate truth, or bewilderment regarding the four noble truths, and understanding that, bewilderment regarding cause and effect, you know, the role of karma and action and the result it brings. So confusion and bewilderment about these kinds of important topics, because when we lack clarity on those things, then we actively misconstrue them as well. Because often when we talk about ignorance, we have a lack of clarity, and then in addition to that, a misconstrual or a distortion of what we misapprehend. And so it seems like when they talk about the relationship between non-bewilderment and intelligence, that it's kind of like a parallel thing, except on the constructive side, that the bewilderment is an absence of the non-bewilderment is an absence of the unclarity and confusion, and then intelligence or wisdom would be the mental factor that actually understands the thing as it is. It seems like there's a parallel between those two ways of talking about ignorance and then these two mental factors of non-bewilderment and intelligence or wisdom. Okay, so there's the non-bewilderment arises in the same four ways as the wisdom does. So some of it is inborn. In other words, we carry it with us from previous lives. It's a result of what we've built up in previous lives. So we all come into life with a certain amount of non-bewilderment, and in addition a certain amount of the mental factor of wisdom, according to what we've done in previous lives. So if we, you know, studied and practiced Dharma very well in previous lives, this mental factor is going to be a lot stronger than if we haven't. Okay? But that's only one of the types of non-bewilderment, and it's nothing to be proud of if we have it, because there's three other types, and they're all generated in this life. Okay? So there's the type of non-bewilderment that arises from hearing teachings, and then from reflecting or thinking about the teachings, and then from meditating on the teachings. And so these three arise in this very life through our own effort and enthusiasm and practice. So, you know, we may be born with however much, non-bewilderment we have, but then we can definitely increase it. And the first step to doing that is to hear teachings. And so it's really, really important to hear teachings, because it's only through hearing teachings that we're going to learn, that we're going to have the basis for thinking over in our own mind what exists and what doesn't exist, and how are things really. If we don't hear teachings and we simply kind of go along with all of our own preconceptions and beliefs, then it's going to be very difficult to cultivate any kind of wisdom or non-bewilderment. Okay? Especially regarding things like the two truths. I mean, because we don't have even the foggiest idea of the ultimate nature of reality. You know, I mean, we definitely need to learn about it in order to think about it and in order to eventually perceive it. So, you know, many of these things, also about cause and effect, we don't innately know about that. We certainly don't learn it in school. So we need to hear teaching. And so my teachers have always really stressed the importance of coming to teachings, because they say that you know, even though meditation, you know, and full integration in our life is the ultimate goal that we want to do, in order to do that, we have to prepare for it. And so if we just want to meditate, but we have no idea how to meditate, or what to meditate on, or what is concentration and what isn't, or even what is a positive attitude and what isn't, or what is reality and what isn't, if we have no mental tools inside of ourselves to discriminate that, except all of the garbage we've learned already in previous lives, you know, then even we sit down and meditate, we're not going to get very far. Because we're just going to be get all contorted and twisted up in our own preconceptions. So if we want to meditate, then it really pays off to learn something first, and then to reflect on it and really understand it well, and then to meditate on it and really integrate it in our life. So this is a gradual process, and this comes over and over and over again in the teachings. And I think they must talk about it again, because we probably listen and don't do it. So they have to remind us again and again about the importance of this. And it's really easy to get stuck on any of these four points. Sometimes we think, oh, well, I just have innate intelligence, or I just have innate non-bewilderment from my previous lives. You know, so then we get all proud and puffy because somehow we seem to understand Dharma better than everybody else, and then we get lazy because we don't do anything. So we get stuck on that one. Or sometimes, you know, we hear teachings, which is very good, but we get stuck on the hearing and we never go any further. And so we just learn all the words, you know, we can rattle off the definitions, we know all the words, you know, but we don't really get it, you know. Somehow we have a lot of information up here, but we don't really understand it, we can't really get it. Somebody asks us a question that requires us to apply the information to life, and it's like we're going, I don't know, but here's the definition from the book, you know. So that's, we get stuck. The hearing is very important, but we shouldn't get stuck there. Okay, we need to go on to the thinking, to the reflection, which enables us really to think about it deeply, make many examples, try and apply it to our life, try and think of how it relates to all these different things. This is so important in Dharma. Dharma isn't just about learning words and definitions and scriptures. It's about really thinking, well, how does this relate to my life and to what's going on and to what I see? And, you know, like when we're studying all these mental factors, it isn't just memorizing the definitions, but can we find these mental factors in ourselves? Can we discriminate them within ourselves? Do we know at any particular moment what mental factor is arising in our mind? Or when something, you were having a strong emotion, are we able to identify which mental factor it is? Are we just, you know, completely blown away by the emotion? Or are we just completely oblivious to our emotion and, you know, we're so out of touch with what we're experiencing that, you know, we can't even tell what it is? Okay? So that's why it's really important to think and reflect upon what we hear and really try and understand it from many, many different ways. And then after that, then we go on to the stage of meditation and real integration with our life, because we've understood it properly, so then when we integrate it and practice it, it really goes in deeply and it makes some very profound changes. Okay? So it's, you know, we don't want to get stuck at any of those levels, but we also don't want to skip any of those levels either. So we come back to the famous middle way.
Explain a little better the difference between the functional stage and meditative stage. Mm. Because, I mean, the reality of meditation itself is like a function.
It is.
Right.
Well, the analytic meditation that we're doing the way we do it is very much the reflective stage. And then the actual meditation comes when we have high degrees of concentration. And we can do the analysis, and then when we get to the conclusion, focus with concentration on the conclusion so that that conclusion really permeates us. Okay? So a lot of what we're doing now because we're just learning Buddhism and we're trying to figure it out, what it's all about, and make sure we understand how it's different from Christianity and psychology, you know? And so a lot of what we're doing is at the stage of reflection and thinking about it. And that's a very important stage, actually, you know? Because if we don't understand it properly, we can't integrate it. So a lot of the checking meditation we do now is very much that second stage. And then the other kind of meditation that we're talking about here is when there's a high degree of concentration and we really focus single-pointedly on the conclusion. Okay. And also included in this stage of reflection and thinking is discussing with people. Okay, so that's why in the Tibetan system you have all the debate. Okay, it's extremely important that we discuss things. So, you know, the Tibetans have this stylized way of discussion, yeah? And it's very nice and it's great if you're a teenage boy with lots of testosterone and you need to jump around and throw things and shout, okay? I think that's one reason why they developed that, yeah? Very good for teenage boys. that's not the only reason, but I think that's one. You think so? Oh, well, it's great. It's this huge thing. They have one person who sits down, you know, with their hat on and, you know, and then the other guy who stands up who, you know, wraps their zen around their waist and they have their mala and they're going, ah, you know, they scream at each other. Really? I mean, they scream at each other and they shout and they clap and they jump around and they call each other names. And yeah. You know, so, yeah. But it makes people really think, because the questions are getting fired at you very quick. And sometimes more than one person is firing the questions. So, I mean, you really have to know your stuff and you have to think quickly. Yeah. And you have to not be intimidated because you're sitting down and they're all jumping up around you, okay? So I think a Western way of doing this is, you know, the kind of discussion that we have with our Dharma friends, which is very, very important, and the kind of sharing, like what we were doing on the retreat when we would really talk about, you know, what our doubts are and get everybody else's take on it. And the kind of discussion we do here in class, I think that's really, really important. Okay? So again, Dharma isn't just about, you know, hearing something, going home, memorizing it, and sitting on our cushion. It's really important we discuss and make sure we understand correctly. You know, because just reading the book alone is not going to give us the correct understanding. It's only when we discuss it and we try and explain it to somebody and try and answer other people's questions and really reveal what our own questions are, that we begin to develop a deeper understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I didn't mean to give it a particular twist. It's something quite wonderful. Completely different motivation, too, because often in the West, debate is done with the motivation of competition and to come out victorious. And in Dharma, you know, hopefully, not always, it depends on the individual's mind, debate is carried on with the attitude of helping each other understand how things are. You know? Right. And so similarly, you know, when we have discussion amongst each other, it's not about, you know, making ourselves look good or knowledgeable for the other people in the group. It's about really helping each other so that we all learn and grow on the path. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It sometimes is, you know, and the teachers warn about it. They do say, you know, check your mind and make sure you So again, it depends very much on the individual state of mind. But I think for us, this whole thing of discussion is incredibly important. Yeah? And really sharing and learning from each other. And again, it's the thing of listening too, isn't it? You know, because to discuss, we have to listen and really take in what the other person's saying and think about what they're saying. And also in discussion, we have to make ourselves a little bit vulnerable and, you know, say our doubts and our questions and stuff like that. But it's interesting. I mean, sometimes I wonder, you know, why do we feel vulnerable when we say our doubts and questions? What's there to feel vulnerable about? You know, what's the attitude in our mind that's going on saying, you know, I don't want to say this. You know, what is it? Yeah. Yeah. Which of the eight worldly dharmas is it? Which of the eight worldly dharmas is it? Of the eight worldly concerns? Yeah? Yeah. Has to do with reputation, doesn't it? I don't want to look like an idiot by asking a question. I don't want to look like an idiot by saying I don't understand something or I doubt something, because I'm sure everybody else in the room is clear on it. You know, I'm the only one. Yeah. There's very much attachment to reputation, isn't it? And that attachment prevents us from learning and growing. It's a big obstacle. And it's kind of a form of pride, too, isn't it? Yeah. And so, you know, we don't say what our doubts and questions are. We just sit there very smugly, you know, kind of judging everybody else. But we don't want to say anything because we're afraid they're going to judge us. Why are we afraid that they're going to judge us? Because we're judging them. Very interesting. I talked to a friend of mine who sometimes is very shy. She doesn't say very much. And she, you know, and she's a meditator, so she saw over a period of years that one of the reasons why she was shy was because she was proud. Yeah? Because she could, you know, just sit there and not have to put herself online and be judgmental of the other people, but not have to, you know. And she was saying that her fear of saying something was because she was afraid the others would judge her. And the reason she was afraid was clearly because that's how she approached them. It was very interesting. So, you know, I think it's helpful to look in our own mind, and, you know, that whole thing we have about being vulnerable, what's that all about? You know, is there any valid basis to that? And even if we ask a question and everybody laughs, so what? My reputation rule, that's what, so what? I don't want that. Okay. So, this non-bewilderment accompanies the intelligence, or the wisdom, and that wisdom thoroughly analyzes the meaning of the object or the true nature of the object. So, you know, this kind of non-bewilderment, you know, is together with a mind that is a very deep understanding and kind of analytical wisdom. Okay? What else? Just to clarify this whole debate about, for those who, you know, those who are saying, many people say it's not the same as this intelligence. Well, the reasons why they say it's not the same, this is not the same mental factor as intelligence, is they say that they have two different functions. That the function of non-bewilderment is to prevent misdeeds and wrong conduct, and the function of intelligence is to overcome doubts. So that's one way that they discriminate them. Another reason they say that they can't be the same mental factor is because then it's redundant. Then you have like two of the same, you know, kind of, why have two mental factors if it's one mental factor? And if it's two mental factors, you can only have one at a time. So which ones you have? So, you know, that's another reason. And then the third reason is because, like this parallel with the development of ignorance that I was saying before, that first there's the non-clarity and then there's the active distortion. So in this development, then what's comparable is you have the non-bewilderment, which is the clarity, and then the wisdom, which actually overcomes the distortion by analytically, you know, being able to see how things are. That first, that you have together, you know, the non-bewilderment, which is a clarity, and the wisdom, which, you know, through its own analytic ability is able to understand the nature of things. Okay? So you have that, those two mental factors together. Yeah. Yeah. They both have this thing of the inborn, the one developed through hearing, through reflection, and through meditation. Okay, so that's actually, I think, quite encouraging that that three-quarters of it is developed in this life through our own effort. Yeah, three-quarters of the categories anyway. I mean, hopefully more than three-quarters of our non-bewilderment and intelligence will be developed in this lifetime. But it's good, because if we spend our time really thinking and reflecting on the teachings this lifetime through hearing, reflection, and meditation, then next lifetime we're going to have much more of the inborn non-bewilderment and the inborn intelligence. Yeah, but you get the inborn part next life by cultivating the other three this life. So, yeah, there's no completely free ride. Okay, so these three, the non-attachment, non-anger, and non-bewilderment, they counteract the three poisonous attitudes, which are attachment, anger, and ignorance. Okay? And it also corresponds with like the three principles of the path, because it's principally attachment that prevents us from generating the determination to be free. So the non-attachment helps us overcome that. It's principally anger that helps us, that prevents us from generating bodhicitta, so the non-hatred helps us overcome that. And it's principally ignorance, you know, bewilderment that prevents us from realizing the wisdom, realizing emptiness, so the non-bewilderment overcomes that. So it relates also, these three, to the three principles of the path. So these three are quite important. And so it's really interesting, I mean, especially those of you who just got done doing retreat, you know, recognize that as you were doing retreat, you know, these 11 virtuous mental factors are the ones that you were spending a lot of time cultivating. You know, these 11 plus the 5 object ascertaining ones. You spent a lot of time, you know, deliberately cultivating these ones and making them stronger and creating habits in them. And so as you did all the various, you know, longer meditations and things like that, all these things got much stronger, and especially the non-attachment, the non-hatred, and the non-bewilderment. Okay, so this is what the retreat was all about. You know, that there's something going on there. Yeah, something quite good. Okay, so these last three are often called the three roots of virtues, and because they counteract the three poisons. Okay? So we develop these three by meditating on the Lamrim, the gradual path to enlightenment, and also meditating on the thought training, you know, the thought transformation, which is Wednesday night's class. Okay. Questions, comments? Okay, let's sit quietly. And do some reflection on these and try and, you know, figure out how to make them increase. Try and make examples in your mind of when they've arisen so that you can learn to identify, especially these three nons. When in your meditation, try and identify when these three are in your mind and try and think of what specific meditations you need to do that will help you actively cultivate them.